Chapter 106. Attorney and client, the name of Mr. Voles, preceded by the legend Ground Floor, is inscribed upon a doorpost in Simmons Inn, Chancery Lane. A little, pale, wall-eyed, we begin in like a large dustbin of two compartments and a sifter. It looks as if Simmons were a sparing man in his way, and constructed it in of old building materials which took kindly to the dry rot, and to dirt, and all things decaying and dismal, and perpetuated Simmons' memory with congenial shabbiness. Quartered in this dingy hatchment commemorative of Simmons are the legal bearings of Mr. Voles. Mr. Voles' office, in disposition retiring and in situation retired, is squeezed up in a corner, and blinks at a dead wall. 3 feet of knotty floor dark passage bring the client to Mr. Voles' jet-black door, in an angle profoundly dark on the brightest midsummer morning, and encumbered by a black bulkhead of cellarage staircase against which belated civilians generally strike their brows. Mr. Voles' chambers are on so small a scale that one clerk can open the door without getting off his stool, while the other who elbows him at the same desk has equal facilities for poking the fire. A smell as of unwholesome sheep blending with the smell of must and dust is referable to the nightly and often daily consumption of mutton fat in candles, and to the fretting of parchment forms and skins in greasy drawers. The atmosphere is otherwise stale and close. The place was last painted or whitewashed beyond the memory of man, and the two chimneys smoke, and there is a loose outer surface of soot everywhere, and the dull cracked windows in their heavy frames have but one piece of character in them, which is a determination to be always dirty, and always shut unless coerced. This accounts for the phenomenon of the weaker of the two usually having a bundle of firewood thrust between its jaws in hot weather. Mr. Voles is a very respectable man. He has not a large business, but he is a very respectable man. He is allowed by the greater attorneys who have made good fortunes, or are making them, to be a most respectable man. He never misses a chance in his practice, which is a mark of respectability. He never takes any pleasure, which is another mark of respectability. He is reserved and serious, which is another mark of respectability. His digestion is impaired, which is highly respectable. And he is making hay of the grass which is flesh, for his three daughters. And his father is dependent on him in the Vale of Taunton. The one great principle of the English law is to make business for itself. There is no other principle distinctly, certainly, and consistently maintained through all its narrow turnings. Viewed by this light, it becomes a coherent scheme, and not the monstrous maze the laity are apt to think it. Let them but once clearly perceive that its grand principle is to make business for itself at their expense, and surely they will cease to grumble. But not perceiving this quite plainly, only seeing it by halves, in a confused way the laity sometimes suffer in peace and pocket, with a bad grace, and do grumble very much. Then this respectability of Mr. Voles is brought into powerful play against them. Repeal this statute, my good sir, says Mr. Kench to a smarting client. Repeal it, my dear sir? Never, with my consent. Alter this law, sir, and what will be the effect of your rash proceeding on a class of practitioners very worthily represented, allow me to say to you, by the opposite attorney in the case, Mr. Voles? Sir, that class of practitioners would be swept from the face of the earth. Now you cannot afford, I will say, the social system cannot afford to lose an order of men like Mr. Voles. Diligent, persevering, steady, acute in business. My dear sir, I understand your present feelings against the existing state of things, which I grant to be a little hard in your case, but I can never raise my voice for the demolition of a class of men like Mr. Voles. The respectability of Mr. Voles has even been cited with crushing effect before parliamentary committees, as in the following blue minutes of a distinguished attorney's evidence. Question number 517,869: If I understand you, these forms of practice indisputably occasion delay? Answer. Yes, some delay. Question. And great expense? Answer. Most assuredly they cannot be gone through for nothing. Question. And unspeakable vexation? Answer. I am not prepared to say that. They have never given me any vexation. Quite the contrary. Question. But do you think that their abolition would damage a class of practitioners? Answer. I have no doubt of it. Question. Can you instance any type of that class? Answer. Yes. I would unhesitatingly mention Mr. Voles. He would be ruined. Question. Mr. Voles is considered, in the profession, a respectable man? Answer. Which proved fatal to the inquiry for 10 years. Mr. Voles is considered, in the profession, a most respectable man. So in familiar conversation, private authorities no less disinterested will remark that they don't know what this age is coming to, that we are plunging down precipices, that now here is something else gone, that these changes are death to people like Voles, a man of undoubted respectability, with a father in the Vale of Taunton, and 3 daughters at home. Take a few steps more in this direction, say they, and what is to become of Voles' father? Is he to perish? And of Voles' daughters? Are they to be shirt-makers, or governesses? As though, Mr. Voles and his relations being minor cannibal chiefs, and it being proposed to abolish cannibalism, indignant champions were to put the case thus. Make man-eating unlawful, and you starve the Valises. In a word, Mr. Voles, with his 3 daughters and his father in the Vale of Taunton, is continually doing duty, like a piece of timber, to shore up some decayed foundation that has become a pitfall and a nuisance. And with a great many people in a great many instances, the question is never one of a change from wrong to right, which is quite an extraneous consideration, but is always one of injury or advantage to that eminently respectable legion, Voles. The Chancellor is, within these 10 minutes, up for the long vacation. Mr. Voles, and his young client, and several bluebacks hastily stuffed out of all regularity of form, as the larger sort of serpents are in their first gorged state, have returned to the official den. Mr. Voles, quiet and unmoved, as a man of so much respectability ought to be, takes off his close black gloves, as if he were skinning his hands, lifts off his tight hat, as if he were scalping himself, and sits down at his desk. The client throws his hat and gloves upon the ground, tosses them anywhere, without looking after them, or caring where they go, flings himself into a chair, half sighing and half groaning, rests his aching head upon his hand, and looks the portrait of young despair. Again nothing done, says Richard. Nothing, nothing done. Don't say nothing done, sir, returns the placid Voles. That is scarcely fair, sir, scarcely fair. Why, what is done? Says Richard, turning gloomily upon him. That may not be the whole question, returns Voles. The question may branch off into what is doing, what is doing. And what is doing? Asks the moody client. Voles, sitting with his arms on the desk, quietly bringing the tips of his 5 right fingers to meet the tips of his 5 left fingers, and quietly separating them again, and fixedly and slowly looking at his client, replies, a good deal is doing, sir. We have put our shoulders to the wheel, Mr. Carstone, and the wheel is going round. Yes, with action on it. How am I to get through the next 4 or 5 accursed months? Exclaims the young man, rising from his chair and walking about the room. Mr. C. returns Voles, following him close with his eyes wherever he goes. Your spirits are hasty, and I am sorry for it on your account. Excuse me if I recommend you, not to chafe so much, not to be so impetuous, not to wear yourself out so. You should have more patience. You should sustain yourself better. I ought to imitate you, in fact, Mr. Voles, says Richard, sitting down again with an impatient laugh, and beating the devil's tattoo with his boot on the patternless carpet. Sir, returns Voles, always looking at the client, as if he were making a lingering meal of him with his eyes as well as with his professional appetite. Sir, returns Voles with his inward manner of speech and his bloodless quietude, I should not have had the presumption to propose myself as a model for your imitation or any man's. Let me but leave the good name to my three daughters, and that is enough for me. I am not a self-seeker. But since you mention me so pointedly, I will acknowledge that I should like to impart to you a little of my come. Sir, you are disposed to call it insensibility, and I am sure I have no objection say insensibility a little of my insensibility. Mr. Voles, explains the client, somewhat abashed, I had no intention to accuse you of insensibility. I think you had, sir, without knowing it, returns the equable Voles. Very naturally. It is my duty to attend to your interests with a cool head, and I can quite understand that to your excited feelings I may appear, at such times as the present, insensible. My daughters may know me better, my aged father may know me better. But they have known me much longer than you have, and the confiding eye of affection is not the distrustful eye of business. Not that I complain, sir, of the eye of business being distrustful, quite the contrary. In attending to your interests, I wish to have all possible checks upon me. It is right that I should have them, I court inquiry. But your interests demand that I should be cool and methodical, Mr. Carstone. And I cannot be otherwise, no, sir, not even to please you. Mr. Voles, after glancing at the official cat who is patiently watching a mouse's hole, fixes his charmed gaze again on his young client, and proceeds in his buttoned-up, half-audible voice, as if there were an unclean spirit in him that will neither come out nor speak out, what are you to do, sir, you inquire, during the vacation? I should hope you gentlemen of the army may find many means of amusing yourselves, if you give your minds to it. If you had asked me what I was to do during the vacation, I could have answered you more readily. I am to attend to your interests. I am to be found here, day by day, attending to your interests. That is my duty, Mr. C. And term, time or vacation makes no difference to me. If you wish to consult me as to your interests, you will find me here at all times alike. Other professional men go out of town. I don't. Not that I blame them for going, I merely say I don't go. This desk is your rock, sir. Mr. Voles gives it a rap, and it sounds as hollow as a coffin. Not to Richard, though. There is encouragement in the sound to him. Perhaps Mr. Voles knows there is. I am perfectly aware, Mr. Voles, says Richard, more familiarly and good-humoredly, that you are the most reliable fellow in the world, and that to have to do with you is to have to do with a man of business who is not to be hoodwinked. But put yourself in my case, dragging on this dislocated life, sinking deeper and deeper into difficulty every day, continually hoping and continually disappointed. Conscious of change upon change for the worse in myself, and of no change for the better in anything else, and you will find it a dark-looking case sometimes, as I do. You know, says Mr. Voles, that I never give hopes, sir. I told you from the first, Mr. C., that I never give hopes. Particularly in a case like this, where the greater part of the costs comes out of the estate, I should not be considerate of my good name if I gave hopes. It might seem as if costs were my object. Still, when you say there is no change for the better, I must, as a bare matter of fact, deny that. I? Returns Richard, brightening. But how do you make it out? Mr. Carstone, you are represented by, you said just now, a rock. Yes, sir, says Mr. Voles, gently shaking his head and rapping the hollow desk, with a sound as if ashes were falling on ashes, and dust on dust, a rock. That's something. You are separately represented, and no longer hidden and lost in the interests of others. That's something. The suit does not sleep. We wake it up, we air it, we walk it about. That's something. It's not all jaundice, in fact as well as in name. That's something. Nobody has it all his own way now, sir. And that's something, surely. Richard, his face flushing suddenly, strikes the desk with his clenched hand. Mr. Voles, if any man had told me, when I first went to John Jarndyce's house, that he was anything but the disinterested friend he seemed, that he was what he has gradually turned out to be, I could have found no words strong enough to repel the slander. I could not have defended him too ardently. So little did I know of the world. Whereas now I do declare to you, that he becomes to me the embodiment of the suit, that in place of its being an abstraction, it is John Jarndyce, that the more I suffer, the more indignant I am with him, that every new delay and every new disappointment is only a new injury from John Jarndyce's hand. No, no, says Voles. Don't say so. We ought to have patience, all of us. Besides, I never disparage, sir. I never disparage. Mr. Voles, returns the angry client. You know as well as I, that he would have strangled the suit if he could. He was not active in it, Mr. Voles admits with an appearance of reluctance. He certainly was not active in it. But however, he might have had amiable intentions. Who can read the heart, Mr. C? Exclamation point, you can, returns Richard. I, Mr. C. Question mark, well enough, to know what his intentions were. Are not our interests conflicting? Tell me that, says Richard, accompanying his last three words with three raps on his rock of trust. Mr. C. returns Voles, immovable in attitude, and never winking his hungry eyes. I should be wanting in my duty as your professional advisor. I should be departing from my fidelity to your interests, if I represented those interests as identical with the interests of Mr. Jarndyce. They are no such thing, sir. I never impute motives. I both have and am a father, and I never impute motives. But I must not shrink from a professional duty, even if it sows dissensions in families. I understand you to be now consulting me professionally, as to your interests? You are so? I reply, then, they are not identical with those of Mr. Jarndyce. Of course they are not, cries Richard. You found that out long ago. Mr. C. returns Voles, I wish to say no more of any third party than is necessary. I wish to leave my good name unsullied, together with any little property of which I may become possessed through industry and perseverance, to my daughters Emma, Jane, and Caroline. I also desire to live in amity with my professional brethren. When Mr. Skimpole did me the honor, sir, I will not say the very high honor, for I never stooped to flattery of bringing us together in this room, I mentioned to you that I could offer no opinion or advice as to your interests, while those interests were entrusted to another member of the profession. And I spoke in such terms as I was bound to speak of Kenge and Carboy's office, which stands high. You, sir, thought fit to withdraw your interests from that keeping nevertheless, and to offer them to me. You brought them with clean hands, sir, and I accepted them with clean hands. Those interests are now paramount in this office. My digestive. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.